This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. Washington Wise from Charles Schwab is an original podcast that unpacks the stories making news there. Listen at schwab.com/WashingtonWise.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Saudi Arabia comes up with its latest explanation for what happened to journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Does this one make any more sense than any of the earlier ones? And global markets respond to a sell-off in the U.S. as people start trying to figure out what the next step is for the global economy. You are listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, speaking to you from our luxury podcasting studio on the banks of the River Thames in London. I am joined, as always, by my colleague on the line from a secure, undisclosed location, Hugo Restall. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Joe.
And I think that we will jump right in with one of the big global political and increasingly economic stories of the day, which is Saudi Arabia. This has been bubbling along for several weeks now. I know that our editorial page colleagues have discussed it also on our Potomac Watch podcast, the U.S. Implications of this. But the story, of course, is the death under mysterious circumstances, to put it generously, of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi Arabian who had been a U.S. resident writing columns for The Washington Post, who disappeared in the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, some weeks ago. And Hugo, the news today, if you can believe it, is that Saudi Arabia has come up with yet another story for what happened to Khashoggi in that consulate. They now say that actually he was killed and it was a premeditated killing. Previous versions of this had been that, no, he actually walked out of the consulate, and then they claimed that there had been some sort of fight, or we've had theories about a rogue interrogation gone wrong. They're saying it was premeditated. And, what is so fascinating about this story to me is that we've been talking about, the Saudi Arabian government, especially under Prince Mohammed bin Sultan, as, a body that was really trying to reform itself. And yet, you have this story evolving that is creating all kinds of diplomatic and economic tension between the regime and many of its partners, especially the United States. And, there's that old saw about how it isn't the crime, it's the cover-up. Well, here they can't even do the cover-up right.
Right. It does seem a bit Nixonian to me. I mean, all these explanations are, in Nixon's words, a modified limited hangout where they tried to contain the damage and, cut off a few of the diseased limbs in order to save the main tree, which would be Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who is behaving in increasingly erratic and dictatorial ways. So all of these explanations to me suggest that he was involved. I mean, if they had been able to get out and have a convincing explanation relatively early on, it might have been believable that he was not involved. But now, everybody has to suspect that he was, and therefore he is compromised within the Saudi system, and, his enemies will be using this against him. And you have to worry about the stability of the Saudi state. I mean, we had this piece by Karen Elliott House, which I think laid this out very well, that, there are two ways he could go if the opposition to him does mount. One is for his father, the king, to remove him, and the other would be for a violent open struggle, which would be disastrous for not only the country, but the region and the world. So, the strong implication there is that perhaps the Saudi king does need to remove MBS in a timely fashion.
Well, and the timing this week is particularly bad, both for MBS and for Saudi Arabia and its relations with other countries in general, because this was supposed to have been the time when we were going to have this big economic summit that was going to be yet another form of coming out or debutante party for the Saudi Arabian economy, because, of course, a big part of MBS's program has been trying to attract foreign investors. And, right at the moment that this Davos in the desert, people were calling this economic summit, is supposed to be happening, you have this political event intruding to remind people of just how fragile that economic story is. And now, all of a sudden, instead of having this wonderful occasion that's hearkening the opening, the arrival in a new way of the Saudi Arabian economy, this notion that somehow you could recreate a Europe-style economy in the Middle East, you have this reminder that actually it remains a brutally repressive regime with a lot of political problems.
Right. I mean, MBS was trying to hold a system together that was increasingly, I think, unsustainable. I mean, it was basically a system based on sharing the spoils of the oil wealth among an elite. And he wanted to try to reform that, rein in the corruption. I mean, he put all of his relatives and minor princes and business people who had their fingers in the pie, combined them to the Ritz-Carlton and tried to extract their ill-gotten gains from them, tried to open the country to investment. It reminds me a little bit of the Lampedusa novel, The Leopard. I mean, for things to stay the same, everything is going to have to change. I mean, in order for the Saudi monarchy to survive, he really needed to change the system. But, when you start doing that, you make a lot of enemies, you destabilize. And, I think that led him down the road of control freakery, where he had to, be paranoid and he was increasingly sleeping on his yacht, to avoid his enemies. And so he overstepped with this assassination. It really shows the difficulty that an authoritarian state has in trying to change, because as soon as you start to change, that's the most dangerous time. He's caught on the horns of that dilemma.
I mean, it does raise the question in my mind of really how sustainable any of this is now. I mean, any of the the limited political reforms that they've had, under MBS, for example, allowing women to finally drive in Saudi Arabia, or even any of the economic programs, which, I mean, one has to say, there was an awful lot of talk about economic reform under MBS. It wasn't always clear exactly how much had happened yet. And, I mean, now I find myself wondering really how sustainable a lot of this is. I mean, now, certainly with this Davos in the Desert event, there had been a lot of questions about whether business executives should attend that. Yeah, I've kind of had mixed feelings about that. I think that there's a certain amount of, you overburden the business community by expecting them to, take the lead on diplomatic issues such as engagement with Saudi Arabia and the like. But I think that actually points to the bigger danger here, which is actually the nature of some of these diplomatic relationships now. I mean, how does the relationship with the U.S. Congress, for example, look after, something like this killing a fellow who was writing columns for the Washington Post, which is the hometown newspaper for the United States government? Certainly it is going to picket a lot of people in Washington who already had qualms about the Saudi regime's human rights record. I mean, it just really seems like a real danger of backsliding here and reaching the point where maybe there is some damage that is going to take a very long time to overcome.
Right. I think Donald Trump had it right on this and calling it the worst cover-up ever. And our editorial warned that, if Donald Trump doesn't get in front of this in terms of being tougher with the Saudis on this case, there is a danger that the U.S. Congress will take control of U.S.-Saudi policy, and that could turn out to be a very blunt instrument indeed. So, you know, it really does behoove the Trump administration to work behind the scenes to try to get a full accounting of this and get all the damaging information out at once, and then figure out where Saudi Arabia and the U.S. go from there, rather than this, you know, steady drip of revelations and the Turks threatening to openly release all the information that they have. If there's one other thing I wanted to mention is that I think there are some interesting parallels here between the Saudi Crown Prince and Xi Jinping in terms of trying to change the system. Xi Jinping started out saying that he wanted a more market-based system, but in order to consolidate his control, I mean, he has also gone down the road of control freakery, and it's a real question now whether there is any economic reform in China. It looks increasingly like more state control and top-down decision-making. So, you know, an interesting parallel there of dictators who start out with the best of intentions of wanting to make their country more open and seeing the benefits of developed countries and their system, but their political system is incompatible with that, and they end up going down a very different road, which has negative consequences both for the economy and the political system.
Well, I really think that is the important point here. And you know, the comparison to Xi Jinping, the Chinese president who took office a few years ago and has been, you know, seems to be waging an increasingly aggressive political crackdown on some of his you know, opponents within or outside the regime. You know, I think it's an apt comparison just because it's a reminder that actually you can't separate the economic and political reforms to the extent that people have sometimes thought would be possible. And so, you know, if you have a ruler who's claiming to be an economic reformer without also committing to some of the political reforms, you know, maybe the message here is, you know, that people need to be a little warier of that. But we've been talking about the diplomatic crisis engulfing Saudi Arabia, and this is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Joseph Sternberg in London, and I've got my colleague Hugo Restall on the line. And we are going to shift gears now in the second half of today's podcast and talk about the global economy, because, of course, the big market story this week, Hugo, has been a major sell-off again on Wall Street. So the you know, major U.S. stock indexes are now, you know, have given up all of their gains for 2018. That has triggered a lot of concern in Asia, where we had another sell-off overnight in response to the U.S. market developments. You know, Europe, as we speak today on Thursday afternoon, seems to have fared a little bit better, which I guess in this case means somewhat less pessimistically than the other two markets. And, you know, I think to set the stage here, it seems that the real story is that, you know, there seems to be a certain concern about whether you know, we've gotten the mileage that we're going to get out of the U.S. growth story for right now. And, you know, the Fed is normalizing interest rates, which is in the U.S., which is causing investors around the world to think anew about, you know, whether they have adequately been pricing a lot of the risks that they have been taking. And, you know, it seems that this kind of turmoil in the financial markets around the world is a consequence of this process of investors trying to figure out what to make of a new world where maybe the monetary policy in the U.S., it's not normal, but it's not quite as abnormal as it's been before. And that seems to be accentuating a bunch of other risks around the world. I mean, here in Europe, you've got a dispute between Italy and the European Union over the government's budget. You've got a bunch of questions about surrounding various emerging markets in Asia. I guess that's my take on it. And what exactly do you think is going out in Asia in terms of the story?
Well, it's been pretty ugly in Asia. There have been some big falls today in Japan, Korea, Hong Kong market down a fair bit, and Australia. So, I think to some extent this is the normal situation in that when there's a Fed tightening cycle, the rest of the world, really can suffer. We're not in, there's been a lot of talk of decoupling between the U.S. and Asia. And, that has happened to a certain extent. It's not the U.S. Demand for goods doesn't drive the Asian economies in the same way that it used to. But the U.S. still does run the world monetary policy to a large extent. And when the Fed tightens, the pool of liquidity drains away around the world. And, you see particularly the developing markets, the emerging markets, they are faced with a quandary of pressure on their exchange rate. Do they tighten along with the Fed to defend the exchange rate, even though that's going to cause more pain domestically in their real economy? And then if that happens, if their economy slows, do investors lose confidence in the economy and in the ability of their central bank to defend the currency? And you can get into a vicious cycle as Asia did in 1997, where actually defending the currency and tightening leads to more attack and by speculators, and then there's a very very difficult choice for the governments and how to respond.
You talked about decoupling, and I think that it's worth digging into that, because I actually think that there is a form of decoupling going on right now, although not the one that people usually, the sense that people normally associate with that term. So, when I first showed up in Hong Kong about a dozen years ago, and this was before the financial panic and the Great Recession, the buzz was all about this concept of decoupling, which meant that, before that period, there had always been a strong connection between economic growth in the U.S. and economic growth in Asia. The idea behind decoupling was that, suddenly Asia would be able to grow on its own regardless of what was happening in the U.S. Now, I still, for the reasons you set out, have a lot of qualms about whether there really is that kind of independence between, from Asia and the U.S. now. The decoupling that I find a little perplexing that we seem to be seeing around the world, but particularly in the U.S. markets and also in Asia right now, is a form of, I guess, what I would think of as decoupling between Wall Street and Main Street, or the Asian equivalents of that, because the sell-off in the U.S. is happening against a backdrop where actually what's going on in Main Street, the real economy, is still reasonably healthy. I mean, we've had good business investment this year. We've had strong economic growth. We've got, record low unemployment, very strong employment numbers. And yet you still have all of this, disruption going on in the financial market. And my sense is that the same thing is happening in Asia in response to Fed policy moves, where what is happening in terms of the flows of financial capital is becoming somehow divorced from what's actually happening on the ground with economies that actually over the past 10 or 20 years have become much more diversified or much less exposed to crazy credit risks, have a much healthier basis for, sustained, genuine economic growth on the ground.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of Asian economies have prepared relatively well for a storm. After the 2013 taper tantrum, it was kind of a wake-up call. And they've also accumulated a lot of foreign exchange reserves. So they're less vulnerable than they were. China itself is, it's now the second largest economy, and it has significant debt problems, and it's had a massive monetary expansion. And then Japan has also had a very dramatic QE, much more dramatic than the Fed or the ECB. So, you know, you have all of this expansion of money supply. When it goes into reverse, I think that's very unsettling for markets. And the markets then can lead the real economy. With this market contraction, that which China in a way has led. I mean, China's stock markets have been falling, all this year, and that is going to have knock-on effects for availability of credit for real companies. And eventually, I think that we'll see that reflected in the growth numbers.
Now, in this connection, I think we also need to talk about Europe. My little patch of the globe up here in London. Because this is the part of the world where actually I think that there are serious concerns about the Main Street economy, to use the American term for it, and that seem to be feeding into the market activity. I mean, there's a lot of concern right now about the Italian government budget, because there you have the third largest economy in the Eurozone. Has never really recovered from the financial panic of 2007, 2008, and then the Eurozone crises in the years after that. Still very sluggish growth, large problems with non-performing loans, saddling bank balance sheets, very high unemployment. And, you have this fight going on where you have a political development with a new government taking power there that doesn't really seem to have any clear idea on how to revive growth. And I do have the sense that investors here in Europe are responding to the sense that, particularly if there's even the slightest concern that the U.S. or Asia are going to start wobbling, the growth story on the ground here in Europe might not be quite so self-sustaining, that maybe they have again gone through a cycle where instead of launching in domestic reforms here in Europe that would create a genuine European growth engine, they've fallen behind on that process, and so they remain very vulnerable to developments elsewhere.
Right. There hasn't been the kind of reform that was needed. Meanwhile, the debt has expanded, and I think that's something we see in Asia as well, and particularly in China. A failure to undertake the reforms that are your seed corn for the next growth cycle, and you've accumulated all this debt, which is a drag on the economy. You are incredibly vulnerable to a slowdown or a shock from the financial system. And the Chinese economy is naturally slowing as a result of demographic and the stage of development they're at. They're now a middle-income country. So slower growth coupled with a high debt burden and high levels of investment is a bad combination.
Well, we have been talking about global economic growth worries, but we're going to have to leave it there for today. I think we have covered about as much global mayhem and disorder as we can get to in one podcast. So I am going to thank my colleague Hugo Restall for joining today. Thanks, Hugo.
Thank you, Joe.
And thank you all for listening. Please follow us on Twitter. I'm at Joseph Sternberg, all one word, and Hugo is at Hugo Restall, all one word. And be sure to follow this podcast, Foreign Edition, from the Wall Street Journal, wherever you get your audio content. Thanks for listening, and we will chat with you again soon.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.